In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
And thanks for joining us today on the iSpy Radio Show as we continue to keep an eye on big government. Today we're going to talk a lot about science, and here's why. Last week we talked about the Endangered Species Act and the EPA and how far-left organizations, like the Center for Biological Diversity, make millions of dollars from sue and settle, suing the government, in other words you the taxpayer, for not meeting deadlines. I wonder why no one is suing the Obama administration for not meeting the Obamacare deadline. But I digress. Today we're going to talk about how some of these bad policies develop in the first place, like a blanket policy of Oregon's Forestry Department to enforce buffer zones around streams to shade them and keep them cooler, which will theoretically help increase fish production, except it might be having the exact opposite effect. There's a new study out on that. And then later on, we'll go even deeper to talk about the situation in the Klamath and the ranchers there who have an environmental gun to their head to either accept an agency's overruling of a court decision or to have their water shut off and destroy the value of their land. I call it environmental blackmail or simply legalized theft. Be sure to stay tuned for that. And joining us now is Dr. Mike Newton. He's a professor emeritus at Oregon State University College of Forestry, where he has been primarily involved in research on reforestation, the culture of second growth forests, management of stream buffers, and general ecology of forests and watersheds. Dr. Mike, it's an honor to talk to you today.
Well, it's nice to be here.
Yeah, and I'd like to add that you've been really involved with a lot of major research programs, not only just in Oregon, but across the U.S. and around the world. You've had a couple of major appointments, both in the U.S. and in Vietnam, on behalf of the National Academy of Sciences, and you've received a number of awards from the Society of American Foresters. So I get the sense that you're not just some guy that has a new paper that's out there and is making a splash. So you have a very deep and rich scientific background. And we're actually going to get into what has made the splash in just a moment. But I'd actually just like to start with a very brief history of the Forest Protection Act itself. And can you give us a sense of how that developed, but also when did water enter the conversation in terms of protecting forests?
Well, I don't know when the individual things that became part of the administration of the act were added, but most of the important issues were identified immediately following the enactment of the Forest Practices Act. And so I can't attest exactly when, but things like the need for reforestation and the ability to protect the young seedlings and the ability to protect the streams, the Forest Practices Act really was, as you describe, a Forest Protection Act. And most of the major principles involved in protecting what the forest produces were spelled into how the rules were made up after that act was passed.
And one of the things that has really developed out of all of that is this notion that we have to protect streams and have these buffer areas around streams to shade them and keep the waters cool, and which has really interfered with a lot of logging practices. And environmental groups have used this as kind of a hammer to stop logging when they can. And so you have this new study that's come out that has found that the current forestry best practices of having those buffer zones may actually be harming fish production. And, you know, we heard you on Lars Larson's show, and after you hung up, a caller then came in and he said something to the effect of, well, he's just one guy with a paper, so why should we listen? Except I'd like to point out, though, that you're not just some guy with a paper. You've got 350 scientific papers to your name. So give our audience a basic summation of what you studied, your findings, and your conclusions.
About 23 years ago, we were contacted by the Department of Forestry to start doing some stream studies, and it had to do initially with the condition of the riparian areas and their function on the streams. And we had relatively crude measurement devices for measuring stream temperatures, but we recorded quite a bit of information on the relationship between buffers and stream temperatures and what the buffers did to suck water out of streams and various things like that. So over the years, we developed a more sophisticated program, and by 1999, we'd published a paper that said, well, different kinds of buffer strips will give you different kinds of protection, and that maybe it doesn't take all the buffers that were recommended or enacted to provide the protection of stream temperature that we thought. And so that has continued with more experiments, more streams, and so forth. So we have a pretty solid database now on what buffers do to manage stream temperature. We also started collecting some information about how the fish respond to that, but I'm not a fish biologist, so I hesitate to talk a lot about the fish, except that it is a very important part of the question, because that is the resource that needs to be protected. Water temperature needs to be watched simply because it is an important part of the fish habitat. So that's why the recent emphasis has been on temperature and what it takes to maintain cool streams.
And one of the things I'd like to point out, though, that this is not a model that you have developed. This is not some computer-generated model that predicts something. This is based on actual measurements that you took.
Well, that's right. And we have a great many measurements, and we also have attempted to fit some of those data, all of those data, into a model that allows us to explain the contributions of various components of the puzzle. And what's really interesting is that there's so much natural variation that none of the models really fit very well.
And before we talk about consequences, I want to talk about the study itself just briefly, and then we'll get into the consequences in the next segment. I'm sure one of the questions that gets often asked is, has this been peer-reviewed?
Well, yes. Our papers are all peer-reviewed. The rules, I think, have to pass muster somehow, but I'm not aware that they have to pass peer review by a broad range of scientists. So I'm not sure whether that answers your question, but all of our work eventually winds up in peer-reviewed publications.
Okay, we do need to take a break here. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more with Dr. Mike Newton talking about some of the buffer zones and some of the policies that may not be working the way that they think they are. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. I'm your host, Mark Anderson. We're talking today about water issues. And joining us right now is Dr. Mike Newton, a professor emeritus at Oregon State University College of Forestry. He was primarily involved in research on reforestation and the management of stream buffers. And that's really what we're talking about today, is this idea of having a buffer around streams where you have enough forest cover to keep to throw some shade onto the streams and hopefully keep the water a little cooler. And going into the break there, you were talking about some of the models and whatnot, and you had mentioned that the measurements did not fit into the models. Why do you suppose that was?
The nature of a stream is highly variable. It falls, it goes along, glides, it may have pools and so forth, and it's subject to rapid changes in temperature depending on the influence of the environment it's in. And so the water itself moves at some speed downstream, and in the process it gains heat from the very cold water at its source until it equilibrates with the air temperature. And then as it goes down, it adapts to gaps in the shade and deep shade, cool air patches, and cold air drainage coming down valleys and that sort of thing. There's a huge range of variability, so it doesn't fit the models. But one of the things that is really important is that fish are cold water, are cold-blooded critters, and they adapt to a wide variety of temperatures, and it's and the degree to which they are fed has a great deal to do with their tolerance for extremes of warm and cold. Now, very cold water makes for very slow-growing fish, but they can survive, and that's why they hang out through the winter. In summer, they might say they have to sweat when it gets too hot, and so when the water temperature gets up to over 70 degrees, the rate of growth tends to decrease. But when they're very well fed, it doesn't decrease nearly as much as when they're poorly fed. So the amount of shade has a great deal to do with the amount of photosynthesis in the stream, and hence the amount of algae-type stuff that the aquatic insects eat, and hence fish food. So there's a big problem here with the attempts to keep streams cool by shading, because you automatically shut down productivity of the stream and the ability of fish to tolerate warm temperatures. So you wind up with some paradoxes here. The good shade makes for poor fish habitat, poor fish nutrition. So you can't have it both ways.
Yeah, and that's really one of the major findings there of your paper is that these dense forests that are covering streams reduces the photosynthesis. And so basically it sounds like the policy that we've established does keep waters cooler, but it doesn't do fish any good if they're starving. It sounds then like the current policy does almost more harm than good, and might in fact be one of the causes of lower fish counts. Would you take it that way?
Well, some places yes and some places no. And the problem is that the rules are based on one size fits all.
Right,
they
right.
A simple criterion that they're aimed at, whether the water is warmer than that or colder than that. That to me says that the rules need to adapt to the stream environment where you're making the rule apply.
And I find that interesting, too, is that anybody that knows anything about forests knows that there's a wide difference between one forest and another. I mean, certainly on the eastern side of the mountains, there are very different forests than over on the west side or along the coastal range. And I'm surprised, really, that that we do have this blanket one-size-fits-all policy.
Well, that's surprising. And as a person who works in the streams and deals with those variations, I'm startled that there hasn't been some adaptation made, because the people who are working with the rules certainly understand what you've described.
Well, what do you attribute that to then? Why do you think they have this one-size-fits-all approach?
If you have one single criterion, then the enforcement becomes simpler. And of course, if you're going to try to make an adaptive rule, you have to have the kind of information that drives the adaptations you build into the rule. And I think a lot of those data are available, but the complexity of enforcement and how you make measurements and how you determine which streams need buffers and which ones don't, that becomes a real work in progress. And asking the forest practices foresters to gauge just what stream needs what is asking a lot of those people. But what this says to me is if it's too hard to administer, you rule with a whole different stratagem.
Yes, you do. And, you know, I hate to see conspiracies, and that's not my intention in saying this, but it does sound like their goal has been to really shut out access to the forest. And having this one-size-fits-all approach actually helps make that possible.
Well, there are several elements involved here. First of all, there's more than just the temperature of the stream associated with buffers. The current move right now is to see to it that the buffer is tight enough so that any harvesting beyond the buffer doesn't cause the stream to rise more than a half a degree Fahrenheit. Well, that means basically no entry to the buffer. There is no way to manage the buffer to improve its function, to improve its yield of timber, or to increase the food level in the stream. You know, it's antagonistic to almost every objective of forest management to protect streams.
Okay, let's take our break right there. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more with Dr. Mike Newton. We're going to be talking about this continuing policy of buffer zones in the forest. And then later on, we'll be talking with Senator Doug Whitsitt about some of the, well, what I call legalized theft. Stay with us. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today to Dr. Mike Newton, who is a professor emeritus at Oregon State University College of Forestry, and he's been involved in research on reforestation and management of stream buffers really all around the world, has a very deep and rich scientific background. And he has made the news recently with some allegations that the current policy really is not helping fish the way that we think that it is, the policy of keeping streams colder by having these buffer zones around them. And you gave some testimony to the Oregon State Board of Forestry, and some of the findings that you talked about is that basically the policies that we have just are not working. In fact, one of the ones that you found here, this is actually your testimony at the Environmental Quality, and it says that units with no buffer actually have the highest primary productivity, highest temperatures, and most fish. And so if our goal is to raise fish production, it would seem then that this buffer zone actually runs contrary to that. So what was their reaction when you presented this?
Well, it's really kind of different. I thought we got very serious reception by the Environmental Quality Commission, and they listened very carefully and gave me extra time to elaborate on why I was making the suggestions that I did. The Board of Forestry seems to be more constrained by perhaps some legal structure that says that once the EQC has set a criterion, the Board of Forestry has no choice but to regulate so that that criterion or that standard comes as close to being met as is possible. And so the fish turned out, as far as the Board of Forestry is concerned, they have not been dealing with the question of how the fish do. And that is really the core of my urging to change what their approach.
Well, and not only that, but their policies are not only impacting fish production, but it's also harming our ability to go in and harvest the forest. And in fact, you, and again, this is from your testimony, you see that harvesting generally increases productivity of fish while increasing temperature in accord with direct light on water, and that the temperature standard must allow for that. And so, again, we have this policy that is, it seems to not only be harming fish, but also harming our ability to harvest these forests. And so we essentially have all of these, and I think you said earlier, 500,000 acres of buffer zones that are essentially deteriorating.
Well, 500,000 acres is a very serious economic hit.
Sure it is.
And you can't manage them. And the big problem here is that a great many of the buffer strips that are in existence today are of alder rather than Douglas fir, and in order to upgrade those to the Department of Forestry standard, which is a mature Douglas fir stand, you have to remove the alder and establish Douglas fir, and then grow it until it becomes a mature stand. So that means letting some daylight into the stand, into the stream. Our research has shown that if you leave a screen of trees on the south side of the tree, of the stream, and cut right to the water's edge without damaging the bank on the north side of the stream, you get a lot of diffuse light in the stream. You get a chance to rehabilitate the north side and grow timber on most of the protection zone and not change the temperature of the stream any more than you would with the regular standard forest practice rules.
So what's the economic impact then of not harvesting that 500,000 worth of acre?
500,000 acres of that kind of land could grow, oh my goodness, probably owed to the owner maybe a value of $300 or $400 per acre per year. So you multiply that by 500,000 such acres, and you're talking about billions here. And so that's a serious hit.
Billions. And those 500,000 acres, it all grows back. That's what I find so frustrating sometimes about so many of our forest policies, is they seem to forget that it all grows back. In your testimony, you talked about this regulatory paradox that occurs when they want shade over streams to reduce temperatures while ignoring the negative impact of shade on fish. And really, the left has been pushing for lower temperatures in these streams. The left-leaning environmental groups, I should say. Why do you suppose they've singled out that particular issue in terms of lower stream temperatures?
I can't really answer all of the questions about what's in the regulators' minds. They're trying to obey rules by meeting a number, and that number is their target. Whether the fish do or don't thrive is not part of the equation. And then just conducting $1 million more or more stream study, the Department of Forestry collected detailed temperature data, but never a line of data about the resource they're trying to protect. So there's some frustration in my mind about whether our management agencies are allowed to ask the right questions.
So what is, we only have about a minute here with you, what is more important to fish growth and fish population growth, water temperature or availability of food sources?
It's a combination, because their tolerance to temperature is varied by their nutrition level, and so both are important. You can't have a decent fishery if they aren't well fed, and if they are well fed, maximum production is going to be when the water is between 65 and 70 degrees. And it's you can't have it any other way.
Dr. Mike, I want to thank you so much for your time today, and then hope that maybe you'll start changing some minds.
Well, it's been enjoyable to talk to you, and I'm glad to get some of these pictures out where the public can chew on them.
Absolutely. We need that. Thank you again. And coming up, we'll be talking with Senator Doug Whitsitt to get his response from a legislator's point of view about all of this. And you will not want to miss what's happening down in the Klamath. Stay with us. And thanks for staying with us on the iSpy Radio Show. I'm your host, Mark Anderson, talking today, to Senator Doug Whitsitt out of Southern Oregon. He represents the people of District 28, and that is one of the larger districts in Oregon. It includes the counties of Klamath, Lake, and Crook counties, and parts of Jackson and Deschutes as well. Before entering politics, he was a veterinarian with a practice in Klamath Falls. And, you know, Doug, it's always good to talk to you, but I got to tell you, in your most recent newsletter that's going out, I was really upset when I read that that newsletter, because it just sounds like so much of what is happening down there in Southern Oregon is essentially legalized theft. And so we want to get into that with you in the next segment, but I'd like to kind of follow up immediately with, because we just talked with Dr. Mike Newton about some of the science behind some of these policies. And so here we have a scientist that is saying the one-size-fits-all approach doesn't work, and that this whole notion of buffer zones for logging doesn't work. And to develop this policy, they use these computer models and best science. And so what's your take as a legislator about this notion of using best available science? And for that matter, what even constitutes best available science?
Well, first of all, so much of this science is based on false assumptions.
Yes.
That are based on best available science. For instance, Dr. Newton's study refutes the assumption that shaded streams produce more and better fish. The Department of Environmental Quality and Fish and Wildlife made the false assumption, and then that shading the streams would improve the benefit, you know, would improve and benefit fish, and then validated it with the best available science, which in this case was modeled studies that showed that cooler water would produce better fish. However, what they left out was the in their model, when they calibrated their model, was that the primary concern for fish is adequate food. And in the streams, incident sunlight is necessary to produce that adequate food. And so when Dr. Newton began his study, and which went on for 20 years, he determined that, as I'm sure he told you, that the more sunlight on the stream, the more fish food, the better the fish.
That's right.
So the assumption that shading the streams improves fish habitat is just plain wrong.
Yeah.
Yet they continue to move forward on that on those false assumption using their best model of available science. And what I find even more disheartening is that when Dr. Newton's study, which I'm sure was expensive and very time-consuming, 20 years, but when he comes out with all of this empirical, measured data and reasoned analysis, they basically blow him off and say, well, you know, that's just one guy's opinion.
Yeah, and we did talk to him about that. He's not just one guy. I mean, and he's not just a guy that's got a paper that's out there, but he's got a very rich scientific background. And, you know, it's interesting that you talk about this idea of the shades, that shading the stream is somehow going to be more productive for fish. Because, you know, I used to have a fish tank, and one of the things that was very clear is that the more sunlight you had, the more algae would grow in there, and fish like that. But essentially what our policy has done is by closing off the photosynthesis, inhibiting the ability of the algae to grow, essentially what that policy has done is it would be the same effect on our food chain if someone blocked out the sun to slow the growth of grasses in our environment. And you can imagine what that would do. I mean, the cattle production would be down, wheat and rye and oat and all of the other grasses. I mean, if you slowed that production, that would have a huge impact on us. In terms of the best available science, though, one of the things that was striking to me, just because it's best available science doesn't necessarily mean that it's even at all correct. So how do you, as a legislator, then, how are you able to make some impacts on that? Or are you even able to impact that from a legislative standpoint? Or is this all totally in the hands of the policymakers?
In 10 years of standing up and beating my chest and talking about it, I have made very little headway. Best available science too often is the only available science. And for instance, just to give you an example, when they did the Upper Klamath Lake total maximum daily load on the water quality for DEQ, the science on that project was almost entirely bought and paid for by the Klamath tribes.
Mm.
And yet, as you go forward and start trying to punch holes in their best available science, they were quick to point out this is the only available science, and we're required to take the best available science, and since it's the only available science, it's the best available science, therefore it's right. And regardless of the fact that there are so many false assumptions and so many blatant departures from reproducible science, for instance, in that Upper Klamath Lake TM deal, they wanted to determine the sedimentation rates on the lake. They went out and did 3-4-inch cores in a lake with 130 square miles of surface. Those two of those cores, one of them is skewed, one of them inexplicably wasn't used because it didn't comport with what they wanted to say. And so they ended up basing their study on 1 4-inch core in a 130 square mile lake.
Mm.
And then, my wife is a geologist. She got a hold of the raw material for that particular study. And Mr. Eagles, who did the study, pointed out in his notes that he found live larvae clear to the bottom of those cores, which means they've been bioturbated. It means the larvae have gone up. Actually, they were the larvae of the gnats on the lake that are just incredible during the summertime. In any case, they based this, they improved their study, and they validated their study by using this one core that had been stirred by insects. And then they were saying they could do the actual sedimentation. If you want to see somebody go ballistic, you know, see my wife who's a stickerfer, look at that and say, you can't do that.
Wow.
But they did.
Well, unfortunately, we're up against the clock here, so let's go ahead and take a break right there. Everyone stay with us, because coming up, we're going to be talking about what I really consider the legalized theft of land down in the Klamath. Stay with us. And we are back on the iSpy Radio Show talking today to Senator Doug Whitsitt, who represents the people of District 28 in Southern Oregon. And before entering politics, he was a veterinarian with a practice in Klamath Falls. And you know, he has really been a champion, in my opinion, for the people of the Klamath area, both in Oregon and California, an area that constantly struggles with water issues. And, you know, I came across this little factoid as I was putting together your bio here for the show. It says that you and your wife, Gail, own a farm and raise European warmbloods. Is that correct?
Yeah, we pretty well wound that down, but for about 15 years we did that. Yes, we did. As a matter of fact, for a couple of years we had the leading sire of European warmbloods in the United States.
Wow, isn't that interesting? My wife, she used to, I don't think she ever had a warmblood herself, but she loved dressage very much. And so anyway, that's really cool. So we have been talking about some of the science here, and we were talking in the last segment there about best available science. And I think one question needs to be asked yet is, let's say that you've got two competing science reports. One says you need to keep the streams cool. The other says, no, you need it warmer to increase food production. So who then determines what constitutes best available science?
Unfortunately, in my opinion, many of the state agencies are selecting the scientific studies that they wish to validate and then and use those to the exclusions of the ones that would contradict their findings. And it's not just in the state of Oregon, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and other agencies are doing the same thing, in my opinion. They go through the literature, they select studies that whose conclusions support what they're trying to do, and then they leave out the other studies. You look at what's happening here in the climate. The Oregon Water Resources Department has decided that has made the assumption that a number of the irrigation wells in the Upper Basin are interfering with the new tribal water rights that were given to them in the adjudication, and they're saying that they have a modeled study that shows that this is happening. Obviously, a model is nothing more than a spreadsheet with mathematical equations, and you can calibrate it to say whatever you want it to say. And I believe in this case they have. When questioned, they say, no, we can't measure the difference. If you shut down the well, we won't be able to tell the difference in the stream. Mm. But if we shut down several wells, we know that will improve the stream. So we're going to do that.
You know, that just didn't even seem to make logical sense. How is taking groundwater or not taking groundwater, how will that ever affect surface water, you know, running through the streams?
It can in some situations. But if you turn on your well and the spring goes dry, and you turn off your well and the spring comes back, and you turn on your well and the spring goes dry, that's a pretty good indication that's what's causing it.
Hmm.
And that has been part of water law for a lot of years. If you can show substantial and timely interference, you have to shut down your well. And whether it's with the surface water or another well, that's in the law. But what these folks are doing are saying that we believe this is happening. We can't prove it's happening other than through model studies, but we're going to do it anyway.
Wow.
And then when we were looking, we got a bunch of information, about 60 pounds of it, working with the Resources Department on Monday at my request. And we were looking through their evaluation of what they call gaining reaches of the river, where the water where they're saying the groundwater is coming into the river. And they're basing that on some studies in the past, the 2007 USGS study, a 2012 USGS study, and a couple of other USGS studies like in 1958 and 1974. But the point is that there are three studies, one done by COPCO and two done by United States Geological Survey, that emphatically conclude that the pumping of water actually increases the flow of the river in that area. They were done in that area. And so how can they say, when they go to validate their assumptions, they only selected those studies that supported their assumption and completely excluded the three studies that contradict their conclusions.
Yeah, well, it seems to me that they have a policy in mind that they want to push forward, and it doesn't matter then what kind of science you're able to put forward. And it, to me, it's not best available science, it's most palatable science based on the policy, the person that's pushing those policies.
And, you know, I've asked repeatedly, so what is the statistical confidence of your scientific model study? I mean, science is supposed to be statistically reproducible at a statistically confident level. For instance, I mean, 95% statistical confidence, meaning if you ran the same experiment 100 times, the conclusion would be the same 95. They have studiously avoided answering that question wherever we ask it, because I'm assuming they don't have any statistical confidence. And I don't know how they could, because they're it kind of comes back to like with the air quality thing we see in Klamath and Klamath Falls and Lakeview and Prattville. All three of the five towns that they're regulating air quality on are in my district. In each of those areas, they have one monitor, and they model the air quality in the area, in each of the areas, off that one point. How can you do a model with one point?
Yeah, really.
And have any statistical confidence?
Actually, let me go ahead and interrupt you there, because we're getting short on our time, and I really want to make sure that we save enough time in the last segment to talk about what's going on in the Klamath. Thanks for staying with us on iSpy. I'm your host, Mark Anderson, and talking today to Senator Doug Whitsitt out of Southern Oregon, and we're talking about water issues. And one of the biggest things down there in the Klamath Basin area is water. And we got an email from you with your latest newsletter about some of the latest developments. Can you go ahead and walk us through what that means? Because to me, I mean, this just sounds like they're really forcing an unconditional surrender.
It sometimes appears that way. The Water Resources Department completed the Klamath River adjudication, the administrative part of it, in the March of last year. And they followed the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decisions in that the tribes have a time immemorial water right for enough water to maintain their hunting and fishing and gathering rights as they were practiced at the time of the court decision. But the Ninth Circuit also said that the water that was made available to the tribes for in-stream flow to protect those rights should be no more or no less than was being used at the time of the decision. And that they specifically pointed out that we should not try to return this area to wilderness servitude. Yet that is precisely what the Oregon Water Resources Department did in their adjudication. They gave all of the surface water, virtually all the surface water in the tributary to Upper Klamath Lake to the tribes. And they gave a lake level in Upper Klamath Lake to the tribes that arguably is not attainable without the Link River Dam. So, and that's still hard to go back to 1864, since the dam was built in 1921. In any case, so you have that, the surface water was all given to tribes. Then the Water Resources Department came forward with the idea that these irrigation wells, some 260 irrigation wells, have the potential to interfere with the tribal water right. And they did a regional groundwater study, now have individual model studies for each well, that prove this supposedly that about 81 of those wells are causing interference with the tribal right, and they will shut down those wells as soon as the tribes make a call this spring, because they do it on priority, and of course the wells have a much less priority date than the surface water does. So what we have then is the many of the same farmers and ranchers who had their surface water taken by the department's adjudication in 2013 are going to have their irrigation water from wells taken in 2014. Again, we talked earlier about it being what I consider based on false assumptions and false premises, but nonetheless, that's what they intend to do. It has been the agreement that has been reached by the negotiators in the Upper Klamath Basin allows many of those wells to be used. That's still being worked out, but the agreement would allow the farmers and ranchers who've used surface water for decades, some of them for generations, to use some of the surface water, and it would allow them to use some of their wells. But it's been made really clear, if they don't agree, that is contingent on the agreement. If they don't agree, then, if they don't agree to all of the provisions of the agreement, then they will be required to not use the surface water, a.k.a. the adjudication, and Oregon Water Resources Department has made it abundantly clear to them that they will shut down their wells.
Mm.
So yeah, I think there's a concerted effort to get the people to sign on to this agreement. And of course, this agreement also requires their support of the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement and the Klamath Hydroelectric Settlement Agreement, which requires the removal of the dams from the Klamath River. So we have a governor who has an agency who is has both the governor and the agency have signed on to the KBRA and the KHSA and to this agreement, and they're saying that either you guys sign on or we're going to take your water. That's what it amounts to.
Yeah, and that's where I say it just sounds like unconditional surrender, because all of this, and it is a total overwhelming, complete win for everybody on the left. It means that the farmers lose their lands, or they lose the rights to the water. It means, and you didn't even touch on the fact that all of the funding now that is going into the tribes for all of this. The federal government is coming in, giving $147 million in direct funding to the tribes. It requires the United States to purchase 90,000 acres for the tribes and just give it to them. And all of this is in addition to giving them literally all of the water rights in the area. And without water, the farmers' land is practically worthless.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, the agreement as it is contemplated and is being pushed to the tribal members, and it's not clear that the tribal members are going to accept this agreement either. But there, and also being pushed to the irrigators, it's just that. I mean, it's a sign this agreement, and you will be able to use some of the surface water you used to use, and some of the well water that you're used to use, and you will give up various property rights. And yes, the tribes will get a total of about $147 million. A lot of that is in the KBRA. I think there's only about $45 million of it that is actually in this latest agreement.
Yeah.
But then again, this agreement is tied to the other two, so they're pretty well intertwined.
It seems to me that what they're essentially doing is legalizing the theft of that water. They had these water rights going back to the 1800s. The courts agreed with that. The state board then came in, overturned that. And now they're holding a gun to people's heads to give up their water rights and accept these so-called new water rights that the board set, which then completes the legal circle and overturns and circumvents 150 years of water rights. I hate to say it, but we are up against the clock here, and we've got to get going. But thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, you're welcome. It's always a privilege to talk to you. Thanks.
And thank you so much for joining us today on the iSpy Radio Show. We do hope that you're at least a little wiser than when you got here. Let me make something abundantly clear. If the governor wanted to, he could stop this right now. But he not only supports this, it's part of the left's bigger plan for wealth and land transfer to their political allies. What's happening in the Klamath is immoral. These are farmers who bought the land, who worked the land, and this governor is hiding behind his board to push his environmental agenda and to throw out 150 years of legal agreements. It's time to remove this man from office. Any one of the Republicans is a far, far better choice than this puppet of the left whose strings are being pulled by the enviro-Nazis and the healthcare socialists. We've had 27 uninterrupted years of Democrat governors. Look around at the devastation that has caused. It's time to take a stand. Remember, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense.
the iSpy Radio Show.